Why are you so interested in our obsession with apocalyptic thinking?
That's a really great question, and one I wrestled with in writing this book. And I think it actually goes way back to my childhood. I grew up in the suburbs of Texas, and I had my own little portable television in my bedroom in our two-story house in suburbia, right, with two children, the nuclear family. And we had some stations that would show these odd, quirky, apocalyptic films, and from a variety of types, Failsafe, Dr. Strangelove, to the more B-level movies of like Them with the giant ants. And I never really could explain my fascination with these films, because I knew that I never thought ants were going to come get us, or that they were going to have all these scenarios were going to unfold. But at some point, I realized that they were actually really raising questions about human existence and about how we understand what it might be like if we were all gone. What would it really mean if we were to disappear, if we were to obliterate it, ourselves, or if some species was to take over? And so I think at some deep level, they're challenging us to think about the meaning of human existence. And that's always been a question that's intrigued me all the way through my graduate studies and things like that. And so I just had never written a lot about it. And I think the Mayan apocalypse hysteria kind of prompted me to do that. I almost wrote something back in 1999 around Y2K, but I didn't feel like I had enough to say. And so this time I did it.
Hmm. Well, and you talk about what you call the apocalyptic meme. And we should define our terms for a moment here. What do you mean by the apocalyptic meme? What's a meme?
Well, the meme is a term coined by Richard Dawkins in his book The Selfish Gene, and what he meant by the term meme, which is spelled M-E-M-E, is that ideas evolve very much like genes, and so they copy, they replicate, they mutate, and so on, and those memes, like genes, those memes that confer survival advantages will be those that continue to exist. And so a meme, in essence, is really any idea, belief, or behavior that can be copied and replicated and passed along. From the simplest thing is fashion and tattoos and art, to science, to philosophy, to more complex things like worldviews, ideologies, economic systems. All, pretty much everything humans do can be understood in terms of a meme, something that's been copied and replicated and passed along.
And then you say there are sometimes collections of memes, related memes, that are clustered together, what you call meta memes.
Yeah, and again, I'm getting that term from Susan Blackmore, who's done a lot of work extending the ideas of Dawkins and others on memes, and she's really written a very fabulous book called The Meme Machine. But a meta meme is a collection of memes that are all woven in together. So, for example, let's take the meme of capitalism. Well, that has lots of meanings. It has a lot of other lesser memes: corporations, mass production, maybe exploitation, free market, free enterprise, profit, consumer society. It's got a lot of other memes woven into it. The same thing with theologies. There's creation myths and births and deaths and afterlives. And even something like evolution, the science of evolution, has all the other issues associated with Darwinianism, and the idea maybe if you fully ascribe to evolution, then you would be atheistic. And maybe even if you subscribe fully to the Big Bang theory, the expansion universe, within that is the cosmic evolution. There's black hole theory. There's the expanding universe. There's dark energy. So within these larger narratives, like the Big Bang or evolution or capitalism or socialism, there are lots of lesser memes all woven in together.
So you are saying that there is an apocalyptic meme out there.
There's many of them. They're all over the place. Oh,
okay.
Yes.
Well, tell me, what form do these apocalyptic memes take?
Well, you know, we just came off the whole Mayan apocalyptic hysteria. And I think what's interesting in our society is that the Mayan apocalypse, even though 27% of Americans believed that it was likely to happen, I think most Americans...
Wait, you're saying 27% of Americans thought the world was going to end like the Mayan prophecy?
Yes, according to a survey by National Geographic, yes.
Really?
Yes, 27% thought it was likely to happen. The number in China was 20%. And another survey, in my book, I have several surveys there. The percentages of people believing in apocalyptic scenarios is extremely high. And they're out there, and you just wouldn't think it. And it's not really just among what you might think a fringe element or something like that. For example, and I'm just turned to a page in my book here, 37% of Americans believe that the day after tomorrow could happen. And that's the Roland Emmerich film about instant climate change and instant ice age. 31% believe that Armageddon could happen. That's the one with the meteor hitting us. And, of course, we know what happened yesterday. A meteor kind of hit into the skies of Russia there. And I could go on a list here. There's a whole list of them. The surveys that I did not conduct, I just picked up from, you know, Pew and various other sources. So there's been there are a lot of beliefs out there, various apocalyptic scenarios. The Mayan one was easy to discredit, but I think that kind of worked as a cover story because let's face it, the war on terror is apocalyptic. I mean, let's look at Afghanistan. What has happened to Afghanistan after the Soviet Union invaded in 1979 and 80, and that lasted a decade, and then with the Americans and since 9/11. So that's apocalyptic. Iraq is apocalyptic. I think you could say that war itself is apocalyptic, and humans have been waging war for a long, long time. In fact, in the new millennium, since the year 2000, humans have spent over $15 trillion on war and military. That's $2,000 a person waging warfare.
This obsession with the coming end of the world, I mean, it helps to explain a lot of the books and movies and TV shows that trade on this idea. And, you know, dystopianism obviously fits into this as well. You know, and the sort of the sci-fi fantasy stuff, zombies, vampires, it's all sort of part of the same thing. But then I guess it raises the question, well, are all those movies and books and TV shows creating this apocalyptic fervor, or are they reflecting it?
I think it's probably both, because growing up in the Cold War, which ended in 1990 and 91, there was the fear of the nuclear apocalypse. That is not on the radar near as much, although it might be because there's still over 22,000 nuclear warheads in the world. But we now have the ecological apocalypse, whether that's measured as climate change, rising ocean levels, global warming, ecological destruction. There's also the idea of a resource apocalypse, that we're going to exhaust the Earth's resources. Then there's a variety of technological apocalypses. In other words, maybe the nuclear power plants will melt down, or maybe we're going to run out of energy. And there's also the idea of the digital apocalypse, that we will create these machines that will be so powerful and so small that they will go in and alter human consciousness and create a new human. So the real human will be gone and be replaced by some kind of digitalized human. That's sort of the Ray Kurzweil scenario.
Right.
And you mentioned the zombie apocalypse. And I would say there's two others. The cosmic apocalypse, the idea that Earth could get obliterated by the cosmos, be it a meteor, asteroid, zombie, black hole, supernova. The science shows on television do a lot of to further that idea that the universe could wipe us out. There's a show called The Universe that shows up on the History Channel, and they have numerous scenarios with these scientists sort of gleefully explaining the ways the Earth could meet its demise.
This is how the scientists can get on television, you know, predict the end of the Earth.
That's right, exactly. In fact, these guys, you would think they were like Roland Emmerich announcing the new blockbuster, you know?
Well, I mean, there's kind of a paradox here. I mean, going back to this idea of the meme, and again, I mean, if we draw the analogy to evolution, I mean, for creatures to exist into the next generation, they have to be successful. They have to reproduce, which raises the question of why are these doom and gloom scenarios so popular? I mean, you know, they're kind of frightening. Why do people get off on them?
Well, it's interesting because as a meme, to survive, they have to have some kind of advantage. And so in my book, I list seven advantages or seven benefits. All of these apocalypse scenarios offer what-if scenarios. What if this happened? What if we had an ice age? What if the temperature of the Earth heated up? What if extraterrestrials came to us and our planet and decided to wipe us out? What if we had a nuclear meltdown, as in the China syndrome? And so they have all these what-if scenarios, but embedded in that is the possibility that something could end. Is it going to be the end of industrial civilization, the end of humanity, the end of capitalism, whatever it might be? But pregnant in an end is also a beginning. Oh, wow, if we could just get past this wave of destruction, we'll have a new chance for a beginning. So the scenarios always have embedded, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, an end and a beginning. And spinning off those two things, because everybody kind of wants to know how things are going to end, right? We want to know, hey, this is going to end, and hey, there's a new possibility, right? We always have those in our lives because we were born and we know we're going to die. So ends and beginnings are important.
So you're really talking about rebirth then. I mean, the sort of
yes,
the fantasy
exactly.
that, you know, the old, the corrupt, the decaying will be wiped clean and we'll have a new, fresh, wonderful start.
Right. It's just what Madison Avenue promises with so many products, right? You'll get a new beginning, a new chance to begin again, and the old will be swept away. So one of the ends that's terrifying is this sort of fear of the future, the idea that somehow the future is messed up. Somehow it's going to get worse, that the good old days are better than the days to come, that tomorrow is going to be terrifying and we got to go back to yesterday. And that fear of the future undergirds a lot of these sort of conservative or neoconservative apocalyptic scenarios, cultural apocalypses, whether it's immigration or gay rights, all the things that are perceived as largely negative by conservatives or fundamentalists or evangelicals or whatever. And so all that sort of fear of the future, or there's just simply no future. And I think that was part of the fear of the Cold War, is that somehow we knew that we could immediately get wiped out and there might not be a long-term future. And so there have been any number of films that have dealt with that, from Dr. Strangelove to Failsafe. I would say even a film like The Matrix has a deep fear of the future. But another benefit is the idea that somehow out of this there'll be a transformation of human consciousness, that somehow we'll come out a better species if we just survive it. And this is a very optimistic view. Once we survive our mistakes, once we conquer climate change, we'll be transformed. Or maybe by transforming consciousness, we'll conquer the climate problems. And I think that's sort of in what's in Al Gore's message, is that somehow we can transform human consciousness and society to cooperate on a global scale to fend off severe climate change. And so that's what makes his view so optimistic, as opposed to the many much more pessimistic views of climate change.
Well, and my guess is that this apocalyptic meme operates at some emotional level as well. And you have this fascinating discussion in your book about how experiencing sort of this sense of the apocalypse allows us to get to the sublime, you know, which is almost sort of a religious experience. Can you explain this?
Well, I would say that the sublime doesn't have to be a religious experience at all. I would say the sublime is the sense of awe and wonder, often tinged with terror. And it's that feeling when we gaze upon the stars in a night sky, on a clear night sky, you know, away from the cities where we can actually see the stars. We see the radiant ribbon of the Milky Way going across the sky. So we're in awe and wonder. Or maybe we're standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon and we look down in it and we experience this awe and wonder. So the sublime is what happens when we experience awe and wonder when we confront several different things, one of which would be the vast forces of nature, the forces that made the Grand Canyon, the forces of the cosmos, maybe the forces of a tidal wave or something like that. And so we can see it, and it's awe-inspiring, and yet perhaps it's terrifying, especially, you know, a tsunami or a volcano or something like that, where you get awe and terrifying at the same time. We can also have a sense of the technological sublime. In other words, we can marvel at the powers of the internet, and just to sort of contemplate the fact that there's 1.5 billion people hooked up to the internet. No, I think it's more than that. I think it's up to 2 billion now, whatever the total is. But we have billions of people hooked up to the internet, and it's been running for over 25 years without ever turning off. And we can sort of contemplate this vast network that we're building. It's awe-inspiring, but yet its surveillance powers are terrifying. Its ability to trivialize knowledge down to, you know, the 30-second soundbite on YouTube is also kind of terrifying. So we have the technological sublime, the natural sublime, and there's also the cosmic sublime, as I mentioned, looking out and seeing the vast cosmos. But what happens with vast amounts of destruction, it also generates the sublime, but mostly in a terrifying sense. And I think those people who saw the first atomic bomb explode in Trinity in New Mexico experiences, they were terrified by what happened. And of course, the people who saw the Hiroshima and Nagasaki were equally terrified when seeing this massive force of nature and technology unleashed. So I can say that I was driving through New Orleans about 9 months after Katrina hit, and there were vast areas of New Orleans that were uninhabited, and it was just, you could see there was just mud everywhere that had come up from the tidal surge and also from the levee break. And it was awesome, but it was terrifying at the same time. And I don't mean to say it was beautiful. It was just like, wow, look at this amazing destruction. And then once you're going in it, you can sort of appreciate what it might have been, the terror that was felt by the people who were actually there when the hurricane was coming through. So the sublime can give us this sense of something awesome, powerful, amazing, and even wondrous has happened. But if it's life-threatening or challenges our worldview or challenges our sense of how big we are in the universe, some people might find it terrifying, too.
Well, I want to go back to this idea of the cosmic sublime, sort of the, you know, tapping into the larger universe. And you make the point that, to some degree, it goes back to that very famous Apollo 8 photo from 1968, you know, the first photo that that showed the Earth from, you know, these astronauts who were circling the moon, and arguably the most influential photograph in history. Tell me why that had such an impact.
Well, I think it had an impact because it was the first time we were able to get off the planet and look back at the planet. And as several of the astronauts had referred to, we went to the moon, but we discovered Earth. But what most people don't know is that let's make sure everybody knows what image we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's called Earthrise. It's the one with Earth rising above the moon's surface. It was captured, I believe, on December 24th by the Apollo 8 astronauts. These were the first astronauts to leave the Earth's orbit and get to the moon. These were not the same astronauts who landed on the moon in 1969. So they had gone there to orbit it, and they were going to, I think, orbit it 10 times and then come back. But on one of their orbits, they captured the Earth. And so what we see is this image of Earth coming up above the blank horizon or the desolate horizon of the moon, and the Earth is floating against a black sky. But that image has been flipped. The original image, Earth was not coming up over the horizon. It was coming around the horizon. The original image, there's nothing under Earth.
So the moon is on the one side, on the right side, and the right Earth is on the left side.
Floating on its own. And why NASA changed that, I think it's pretty clear. The image is much more comforting when Earth is rising above the moon. There's still something under it. It's more like a sunrise, as opposed to Earth, you know, what we would call this image, Earth void, Earth floating in the void there. It just doesn't have the quite ring to it. But I think that idea, seeing Earth floating out there against the dark sky, I find it poetic and beautiful, but I think others find it very terrifying, because if we're really honest about it, we know that that image challenges centuries, millennia of ideologies that put us at the center of the universe, while at the same time verifying Newton's laws of gravity and motion and Galileo's discoveries.
Now, one of the things that came out of that image was tremendous optimism. There was this sense, oh my God, we're all in it together. We're all there on Earth. I mean, it seemed to usher in this new era of global thinking, but that didn't happen.
No, it helped reboot the ecological movement, without a doubt, because seeing Earth from space, you can see that it's the intuitive observation is, wow, there are the clouds over the oceans. I'm betting that the clouds are connected to the oceans, and you can see the deserts, and there's the rainforest or whatever. And you can see that it would be very easy to, based on the science we had then and now, to intuit, wow, it's a collected, integrated ecosystem there. And when you see this image, you don't see any skyscrapers, you don't see any national borders. The only thing you can conclude is, well, humans are one species on this planet along with other species on this planet. And so it had an influence in ecology, but I don't think it had an influence in our cultural ideologies, or at least it didn't have a positive influence, because nothing really changed. The Cold War kept going for another 20 years. Vietnam was raging, and war and mayhem continued on the planet as if that image didn't mean anything.
Well, I'm wondering if it, in the end, if it actually had a negative image. It sort of gave us the sense that we are alone in the cosmos and we are somehow more vulnerable in some profound philosophical sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it suggests we are alone floating there in this vast void, and you can see the black sky there, and that, I wonder what it really means. And I think that you really have to rethink and reboot. The obvious, to me, what seems to be the obvious question is, wow, we should have a global civilization. And I don't mean globalization as it's understood, that meme, but a global civilization that still recognizes differences among individuals, et cetera, but it should be organized in a global way, reflecting kind of the way the ecosystems work and other things we know about that. And after all, humans share 99.5% of the same DNA. We all are from the same DNA pool. So we can figure these things out, but I think it's just too terrifying for most people's ideologies. They cling to these pre-modern memes, these pre-modern narratives, that seem to give them a more secure sense of destiny, because once you look at that image, you realize, hey, we're the ones in charge of this spaceship, and we ought to make sure we're piloting it in the right way to take the, you know, the, that image also helped generate the idea of spaceship Earth floating through the cosmos. And we don't have a flight plan. We don't have a master guide, so we've got to figure it out. And in terms of ecology, we're much, much, much more knowledgeable about our ecological impact on the planet and the way the ecosystems work. But I would say that we still have the same tribal warfare and tribal rivalries that have haunted humanity from the beginning.
Well, let's skip ahead then in our technology to our own time with all of the new technologies, social media, Facebook. Is there any connection between this and, I don't know, that sense of the global, of the cosmic from 40 years ago?
Well, that's a great question, and I've actually discussed this briefly in my but I also have written a paper about this. And one of the things we have to understand is that media technologies, and by this I mean the telescopes we have, the computers, the internet, and things that are able to peer out beyond our night skies into the vast universe. We now know that there's far more than the Milky Way. So on any given night, you walk out away from your city in the remote vastness of the desert, you'll see 3,000 to 4,000 stars, something like that with your naked eye. But the Milky Way has at least 1 to 200 billion stars. There are at least 100 to 200 billion galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. And those galaxies are basically all moving away from each other in vast webs and networks, pushed apart by these vast voids of what apparently is some kind of dark energy. And the universe is enormously vast and enormously old, and we're not at the center of space or the center of time. Science has given us the infinite. But what happens with our stories that we're told to believe back on our planet is, oh, gee, well, there's a creator who's he's guiding our destiny, he's guiding our nation, he's got it all under control for us. And so science gives us the infinite, and then our creation myths give us the infantile, like we're supposed to believe this. And I remark in my book that we have this sort of cultural cosmic doublethink, and the idea that we can have two different systems of astronomy, which are supposed to be plausibly true. And I suggest that we can't do that, that is actually the precursor to the erosion of clear thinking in our society. And by the way, for the readers who don't, or the listeners who don't know, doublethink is George Orwell's concept of believing in two opposite propositions that they're both true and at the same time in the same respect when they're complete opposites, such as war is peace or freedom is slavery. Or in this case, the Big Bang is true and we're still the center of the universe, according to my sacred text, when we're not the center of anything.
Well, so and then I suppose one other parallel then is, just as we are not the center of the universe, you know, in Facebook, there is no center. I mean, there are a multiplicity of, you know, different little nodes.
Yes, exactly, except each user, it seems if you're the center. And I would say that social media are how we counter the effects of cosmic media. Let's say the Hubble telescope looking out is cosmic media. I think social media are the ways we still sort of anchor ourselves. We've got a screen and we can anchor ourselves on that screen. And so, in a sense, when you go into Facebook or to Twitter, it's as if you're the center of the vast network. It's a And in a way, it's a network starring you, about you, integrated around you. And that allows people to orient themselves. And all you have to do is look at today's youth and see how they orient themselves via social media. They anchor themselves in social media as much as they do in their neighborhood. And so you're seeing this sort of in this mediated universe that we inhabit, where the internet is running 24/7 and it's wireless, it's all around us. There's a way to anchor yourself with social media that I think is a existential consolation for the fact that we're not the center of anything. We can pretend like we are. We're the center of nothing, so we can pretend like we're the center of everything. And that's the deepest sort of meaning of Facebook, along with the other elements of narcissism and surveillance and voyeurism and all the other things.
So getting back to our discussion of the apocalypse then, I mean, we're bringing in then, you know, the impact of new technologies. And you write about what you call the virtual apocalypse. What is that?
Facebook.
what makes that apocalyptic, though?
Well, I'm borrowing the term. I did not invent the term virtual apocalypse. I'm borrowing the term from the French, what we might say, the French Marshall McLuhan, the French theorist who sort of extended Marshall McLuhan's ideas, and that would be Jean Baudrillard. And he wrote of a culture in which media had so permeated our world, so permeated our surrounding diaspora of our homes, our houses, our businesses, that what we have is a world in which everything we know to be true and real is filtered through media. It comes through media, such that media, in effect, are destroying reality. The reality in the sense of the original reality or an authentic reality or an untouched reality. So what we have now is what he called a hyper-reality, a world of football games and spectacle and presidential, what appear to be presidential debates and presidential campaigns and these kind of things. And everything is being reorganized under a culture in which the signs of the real are substituted for the real. So we spend more time mediating our lives than living our lives, and he called this the virtual apocalypse, the idea that the real world or the authentic world is being pushed back, pushed away, eroded, or in case maybe even being obliterated by the proliferation of media technologies. And he was sort of put as ground zero for that would be Las Vegas with its simulated hotels, its sort of hotel clones like Paris, Las Vegas, or New York, New York, or Disneyland. And if he was still around today, he died a few years ago, he would probably say Facebook is the same thing because the amount of time spent in Facebook, you're actually creating a world in which your mediated life is more important and more valuable and more seductive than actually a real life.
Well, that's a very cynical view of this. I mean, some people would say, you know, they're having very real interactions with other people they might not be able to, you know, have face-to-face encounters with.
I would say they're having hyper-real reactions or encounters or simulated encounters. I don't think you can get the depth of experience. And this is not a Luddite position. I'm not against Facebook. I'm just trying to explain it here, that I think that it's a simulation of it. I think you can simulate friendship and simulate agreement by you can do a thumbs up, you like it, right, without having to really think about it or analyze it, or you can do a quick thumbs down without really having to critically engage it or things like that. And I think that sort of that it's a simulated experience of friendship, a simulated experience of connecting. I don't think it's the real deal.
We should talk about some of the films that have come out that have played on this whole apocalyptic meme. One that you read about is Lars von Trier's 2011 art house film, Melancholia. How does this tap into these ideas?
Well, in the beginning, the whole planet's getting wiped out, right? He opens up the film with a giant planet 10 times the size of Earth obliterating us. So that pretty much says it's over, right? Now we just get to see what we think about it, right? So the film opens with Earth being obliterated and in the sense of it, in this poetic drama playing out against the vastness of space. And then we see this family of two sisters and a husband play out this drama after her sham of a wedding, and played by Kirsten Dunst, I might add. And so the film starts unfolding as we have one person who sees the world as a world of facades, a world of replicas, a world of phoniness, et cetera. That would be Justine, Kirsten Dunst character, and then the one played by Charlotte Gainsborough is, I think her name was Claire, and she's the one who sees the world more orderly. She kind of accepts the world as is given to her, the consumer society, et cetera. And then there's the husband, Jack, who's the scientist, who looks out into the cosmos and says, hey, look, that planet's not going to hit us. It's going to go around the sun. And he's actually mistaken, and then he commits suicide and whatever. So,
What a cheery, uplifting movie.
Yeah. And so what you see in the film is that Earth is being obliterated. We have one person who's willing to accept it, but also sees the whole society as a world of sham and fraud and, you know, reproductions, replicas, copies, et cetera. And then we have one sister who's trying to maintain a semblance of order and have her child. And, you know, with the SUV and the nice house and the husband, I guess the scientist who apparently had a lot of money. And yet science has no answers. In fact, the scientist actually mispredicts the path of the planet. That would never happen today. Because of Newton's laws of motions and the computers we have, we could plot the arrival of the planet down to the millisecond. That would be no way to make that mistake. So von Trier himself is sort of saying in this film that science doesn't have the answers for what we're really trying to get to about the meaning of human existence in this vast universe in which we perhaps could be obliterated. I mean, we know that objects have hit Earth. Meteor crater in Arizona is a perfect example of that. So we know we could get hit. But I think he's really addressing a deeper question. What is the meaning of human existence? And what does it say about our lives if we can't find that meaning in this vast universe? And for von Trier, I think he sees that there's no meaning. You just have to kind of wing it. And I'm not saying I would agree with that necessarily, but it's sort of a very nihilistic approach to what he's offering in that film.
So a very different kind of apocalyptic movie is Roland Emmerich's 2012. And he's done several apocalyptic movies. Seems to be sort of his stock in trade. But tell me about this movie. What's its message?
I might, before I address that, say one thing. When he did Independence Day, with that's the one with the Will Smith and the flying saucer come, that's really a remake of Earth versus the Flying Saucers from the 1950s. A perfect example of a meme replicating, mutating, and coming out in a new form, so it's still alive, the effect that the extraterrestrials could get us. But in 2012, he's playing off the Mayan apocalypse. And when I went to see the film, I couldn't get any of my more respectable friends to go with me, so I had to go by myself. Couldn't even get my girlfriend to go. And so I went to see it, and I was expecting not to like the film, and actually I enjoyed it very much, and not just because I liked it, but I started seeing a lot of really interesting ideas in the film, so much that I went back the next day to make sure I saw what I saw. And so in the film, there's very little reference to the Mayan apocalypse or anything like that, and I don't really think that Roland Emmerich wanted the science to be taken seriously. I have about 4 or 5 pages in my book about the film, and there's a couple of scenes where you can tell he's not really being serious about it. But what happens over the course of the film, unlike Melancholia, is that while everybody in Melancholia awaits for their fate, in 2012, they're actually going to try to save civilization. And so when you look at what happens in the film, what do they try to do? They try to save the world's greatest art. They try to save some of the literature. They try to save science. And they try to use technology to further enhance the survival of the species in a collective way. And so what happens is that that's a very secular, that's a very utopian narrative. In fact, I would say 2012 is one of the most optimistic utopian films I've ever seen because of its underlying message of what it says could save us if we're smart enough to do it. And so the film is offering an apocalyptic scenario, just like Melancholia, and it's offering an end and a beginning. But the new beginning would be one in which I think at the core of it would be an inclusive society, because there's a scene where they, after one of the giant arcs is getting ready to take off, the leaders didn't really want to let all the other people on, all the sort of masses get on there. And by the way, these are giant arcs. They had like 100,000 people on them each. But they let a bunch of the people on. It was a symbol, and it was a sort of this big intellectual discussion among the leaders about we need to have an inclusive society. Our new world cannot begin with an act of exclusion. So you get this sort of synthesis that it's literature, it's art, it's humaneness, it's inclusiveness, it's constitutionality. Those kinds of things are going to be central to any kind of civilization. And it's clear that in that film he sees humans as one species, because you see cooperations among all ethnicities and all groups on the planet. And it's not merely Bruce Willis or Ben Affleck and big biceps and all that kind of nonsense. It was actually an art historian, a utopian theorist, and a scientist who are the main three heroes, replayed by people from three different ethnicities and gender. And so you saw clearly a cultural diversity message, an inclusive humans are one species message. And what I thought almost every reviewer overlooked, I think, well, they overlooked all of this, is that what the film really had to say about theology and religion, in which the world's religious artifacts are all annihilated and wiped out, and nobody's prayers are answered.
Hmm. You know, despite that hopeful message there, I can't help wondering if we would be better off without these apocalyptic memes. You know, it's why obsess over doom and gloom, which raises the question, is there a better meme out there to think about our future?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there are, for the memes to survive, they have to offer some kind of benefit. And there are a couple of others that I didn't get to, these benefits, one of which is the clean slate. It allows us to imagine a chance to sort of, as you mentioned, set the, you know, sort of sweep aside the mistakes, sweep aside the debris, and start over. And I think everybody in their personal lives has at one time said, man, if I could just start over, I might do something different. Or if I could just get past this big problem, I'll sweep it aside and I'll begin anew. And I think what's true for the individual is also true for society in many ways. And so these films are pregnant not only with doom and gloom, but they're also pregnant with optimistic possibilities, as in the case of 2012, which ends incredibly optimistically. And one of the things about that optimism is it counters the sort of cosmic suicide or the cosmic murder that happens in Melancholia. So you get this sort of clean slate optimism to counter the very doom and gloom that we get in a movie like Melancholia. And I would say sort of at the end of the day, though, there's still this question of our significance in this grand narrative of the universe as revealed by our technologies. And that's what I call the sort of the cosmic apocalypse, the idea that we could be obliterated by the vast universe, but more importantly, what if we're not? What if we just keep going on, and what does it mean to be in this vast universe of which we're seemingly insignificant? And that triggers what I call the philosophical apocalypse. For the fact is our social and cultural and philosophical narratives have not caught up with what our science has revealed. And so if we can justify our existence, given what we've done to this planet and given the incessant warfare, what would we do to justify our existence? And I think there's just very few options that would actually give us a reason to justify our existence in this universe. And that question that's been out there, it's been out there among a few scientists and a few writers, but it's never really gone into popular culture, and it certainly hasn't really been addressed by cultural theories. What does it mean to exist on a tiny planet in a vast universe? Are we insignificant, or have we evolved? Are we one form of cosmic evolution that allows the universe to know itself? Maybe that's our justification to continue to exist, is that we are one small way that the universe has become aware of itself and has created a lot of art and a lot of science and technology to try to know that universe and make meaning of it. That might be the best reason to justify our existence. Surely it's not because of all the tribal wars and imaginary great destinies.
That is a great place to leave it. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, great summing up.
It kind of just rolled off the tongue there, yes.
Well, this was fun, and we covered a lot of ground, and it went really well. So thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.